on a go-forward basis with those that are covered by PERA, although smaller and more entities, it still would be following the same equity on that and catching up on, but not on the backs as much of, much as we had at MSRS with the participants in the plan for PERA in this situation.
So at this point, not hold them accountable?
Is there anyone else that was just to testify on the amendment? 1A.
Madam Chair, if I could make one more comment.
Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, maybe I didn't explain this quite effectively enough, but I could try again here that when you look at the cost for a group of employees, there's the payroll cost and there's a pension cost. And the payroll cost presumably would transfer over to the acquiring entity or the privatizing entity. The pension cost is 7.5% of payroll. That 7.5% doesn't transfer over. They no longer contribute. What they would contribute instead is the estimated 1.4%. So the acquiring entity has a bit of an advantage there in that they don't acquire the 7.5% cost of payroll. They acquire something closer to the 1.4%. So I think I would view that if you're looking just at the pension cost and how that translates to an acquiring entity, that would seem to be a favorable, a fairly good deal for them.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, I have a lot of reservations about this, but I will withdraw the 1A amendment. I do want to just state that, you know, these plans have been underfunded, and I guess to shift that responsibility onto somebody else later on, saying, well, we don't want to burden the existing people with our own underfunding of this for years and years and years. I guess to me, and maybe it's because I don't know enough about these plans yet. I've visited every single one of them. I have a million other questions that I still have about duplicate work being done by each of the different plans or why different provisions are the way they are. And I have many, many questions. And I guess when this bill was brought forward to me, I asked them as many questions as I could, but it wasn't until other entities came to me and said there's great concern, and I know that I want to continue to work with the entities that have come to me around this, and maybe it is not in this 1A1 amendment, but I do still have concerns around this. And I'm a little bit disappointed, but I will withdraw the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
And Senator Jezerski, I don't know exactly what your motion is going to be.
Madam Chair, I would be asking to approve the bill to be laid over in the omnibus pension bill. As written and unamended.
Incorporated in the 2020 pension bill.
Yes.
And if that takes place, Senator, it's your understanding that if that would pass tonight, that it will again come up for discussion at a later time. And that anyone with concerns about this and needing more understanding would have adequate time to testify before the committee and to bring our attention to their problem or their issue, or we can all use this time between tonight and at least two Tuesdays from now to absorb people's reaction, even if they didn't know about this till today. Is that your understanding, Senator?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Ms. Strange.
Amy Strini, policy coordinator for PERA. I would highly, we are more than happy to engage in further conversations. Representative Herr, we would love to have conversations with those stakeholders that do have concerns. Again, this is what we propose, but we also understand we need to communicate effectively with people. So, we commit to that.
And does Mr. Anderson, do you think this concludes all actions that this committee has ever committed about augmentation, and we'll never hear about augmentation again?
Madam Chair, I'm not comfortable. answering that question.
Because it seems like every time that we talk about the subject and think we're lessening the controversy, we get some new people that are all upset with us. But Representative O'Driscoll, you've been explaining it so well tonight that I want you to continue on.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say maybe a fairer question to Mr. Anderson is in PERA, because we have several different plans, do you have any other plans that involve augmentation that you'll be bringing forward to, or are there any legacy augmentation plans? I think that's a fair question for the committee. You might be able to have an answer to that this evening.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, no, I'm not. The only remaining augmentation that I'm aware of is related just to previously privatized members in our general employees retirement plan.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Anderson, that is the bill we are taking up and before us this evening, is that particular group that you're referencing. Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel somewhat in the dark. I represent rural, deep rural. I think Senator Dames, I would consider you deep rural too, and no one has come to us, nor our nursing homes or hospitals, to talk about this issue. So I hope if there is a concern that they would reach out to us, but nobody has. So at this point, so thank you.
Senator Sindrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the end of the 2018 legislative session, this committee was in a joyous spree, if you will, about passing a great pension bill that was going to take us to the promised land, so to speak, relative to being fully funded, whatever that means, by a certain date on into the future in the 2040s, I think. Does doing this bill have anything to do with getting to the promised land, either in a positive or a negative way?
Mr. Anderson.
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Sanjim, yes, $52 million of progress would be achieved by passing this bill. That's the estimate from our actuary. That's the known estimated impact. The unknown estimated impact would be the effect of being able to receive any future withdrawal liability. Like that, okay. That part we don't know. But we can measure at least one component of this, and it's very favorable.
So, Madam Chair, just to make sure, so it gets us to that place $52 million faster. Is that right? Okay, thank you.
Correct. Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I have that, listening to this, when these plans, because in the past, these plans were pretty much fully funded. And we've had some ERPs in the market. We probably have had some ERPs in the market this last week. But if these plans were to be fully funded or overfunded, have a surplus in them, and the same formula being used for withdrawal liability, if there was a privatization when the plan was overfunded, would money be going out of those funds, those plans, to those private employers now, or would how would that work?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, if the plan reaches full funding on that basis, then the entities are free to go. There would be no withdrawal liability cost. And whatever had been contributed would stay in the PERA fund to meet the benefit obligations that had been accrued by the previous employees or the employees of that entity.
Madam Chair, but
Representative Nelson.
But the other part of that question is if they're overfunded, if they're 120% funded and somebody withdraws, what happens to that extra 20%? Does that stay in the fund going forward, or could there be a claim placed using this formula by an entity that's privatizing to a portion of that surplus?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I believe there's no opportunity for any surplus to go to a privatizing entity. In other words, they can't raid that excess that the excess funds would stay within PARA. That's my understanding.
Mr. Burkett.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, the bill does address that specific set of circumstances, and in that case, the withdrawal liability would be considered zero, so there would be no money that transfers back to the privatizing entity.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, I did just want to address really quick the comment that was made about entities not coming forward, and I just, and maybe I'm wrong in this, and maybe Mr. Burkett and Ms. Lincheski could help clarify this for me, but it sounds, but from what I understand, this bill became public yesterday. And I guess that doesn't give people a lot of time to be aware to go to their senators and representatives to say, hey, I have a concern about this bill. And so I did get commitment from the group that came to talk to me that they will reach out to the PARA and also to any individuals who have entities that could be impacted by this, and so I hope that that they will be hearing from them in the next few days, because there was a commitment made that they would, and they became aware of this bill very, very late. So,
Ms. Lincheski,
Chair Murphy, Representative Herr, the three of us are recollecting that it was introduced yesterday, and at that point, it would have been posted on our website and otherwise made available.
Thank you, Ms.
I would just comment that the board of PARA's board took this up in October and went through a very detailed process to determine what the next steps were for our proposal, and that has been on our website since October. So we have, although this bill was introduced yesterday, we have been working through this issue with stakeholders.
Where was the Senate bill introduced?
Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to come forward? If not, Senator Jasinski says that this bill should be incorporated in the 2020 bonding bill, and that
pension
gives,
bill.
Or pension bill. I'm sorry, I keep wanting to do that.
Madam Chair, is that a new request for bonding?
No.
Senator Sedgham didn't even move.
It's just in this room. It's yeah, just this room.
It's the same room.
So close, and we bond so much. Senator, you want this incorporated in the 2020?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move bill. Senate file 4201 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 pension bill.
And that gives anyone that has opposition to this or concerns about this another opportunity to talk about this in the public, as well as to communicate with PERA about your concerns, and Representative Herr and Senator. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Next item on the agenda, Representative Carlson, would you come down on number one?
Number two, ma'am.
Number two.
Or number two on the agenda.
Coming down that aisle is like you're on The Price is Right. I tell ya.
Sorry you had to wait so long. I just knew that one was going to be a hot one.
Oh, Chair Murphy, it was.
But this one is my favorite.
Me too.
This one is my favorite. Because I spent so much time on this last May. Representative Carlson.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. Can I get someone to move my bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I'm hoping that we will have the discussion before the movement of the bill. There is a will on our side to not have it incorporated into omnibus bill because of the fiscal ramifications. And so I think it's a very important bill. Obviously, I'm the Senate author, but I'm also chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate, and I think it would be appropriate to have this move by itself. And I, too, along with you, worked very hard on this last year. We couldn't pull it across the finish line, but to allow it to stay alive and to keep our other great pension bills and the work that we've done in this pension committee alive, I would ask graciously that it would not be moved into the omnibus pension bill. And if there needs to be a vote on that, we can certainly do that. But
let's hear it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the Commission, I'm Representative Andrew Carlson. House File 4018 is a simple bill with significant impact. In short, this proposal aims to extend the sunset date of the 1997 PARA aid program so that funding continues until PARA general plan is fully funded, thus keeping in line with the original intent of the 1997 aid proposal. The bill would provide relief for thousands of county, city, and township employers and fulfills the pledge made by the state at a time to provide partial relief for the then mandated employer contribution increases. This next sentence is, apparently no longer true. From my understanding, this bill is non-controversial and has wide support from members on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. I understand that with every session, we as legislators must take full consideration of every financial ask we have in front of us. On this occasion, however, I would argue that the bill in front of us is not just something that helps local governments in providing property tax relief, but more importantly, represents a symbol of the state government keeping its promises. And with that, members, I know there are several organizations and folks that are here today to provide further context, history, and testimony on this bill. And I do have testifiers.
I think there's been people that signed up for this bill.
Yeah, quite a few.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director for PARA. PARA's board does support the extension of the 1997 local government aid. The aid was established in 1997 with the expectation it would be needed only through 2020. Despite some pretty significant benefit reforms over the past decade, progress to full funding has been delayed. This is primarily due to investment returns below the original assumptions. So during that period of time, that 22-year period of time, the funds return was 7.4%. The assumptions during that time were either 8.5% or 8%. And more recently, there's been a change to use more conservative assumptions going forward. At the March 3rd LCPR meeting, I testified that if all assumptions are met, the expected full funding date of this plan is 2037. Recently, we have experienced some adverse deviations from the assumptions. However, volatility is to be expected, and it's too early to assume a change to the long-term forecasts. Therefore, continuation of employer contributions at the higher level remains important to ensure plan sustainability, and PARA supports the aid extension. Thank you.
Thank you.
To local governments to pay for PARA. Okay. It doesn't go directly into PARA. Fine. Oh, to help local governments pay the higher rate. Okay.
Excuse me. Ms.
Callison. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jan Callison. I'm a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, and I'm pleased to be here tonight. Hennepin County supports this bill restoring the PARA state aid program. As a former mayor of Minnetonka and current Hennepin County commissioner, I want to convey both the county's support for this bill and a local government perspective. As you know, every governmental unit in the state is required by state law to pay for its share of employees' pension costs. The legislature, through the LCPR, establishes contribution rates. We have little or no direct control. The legislature decides the benefit level, all the rules, and the contribution required. In 1997, the legislature passed a significant pension reform bill that increased contribution rates for employers and employees in the PARA general fund. To help local government deal with these increased employer costs, a local government aid program was established and was set to expire on June 30, 2020, when the plan was expected to reach full funding. Despite the fact that PARA has not yet reached full funding, the aid program will end. As the largest local public employer in the state, and as the single largest contributor to the PARA general plan, Hennepin County is acutely aware of the funding of PARA. As we say, should PARA sneeze, Hennepin County catches cold. The PARA state aid program meaningfully helps Hennepin County meet our state mandated costs. Without this state aid, the cost will be shifted onto local governments and onto property taxpayers. As a former mayor of a suburban community that did not and does not get LGA, I will add that the PARA state aid program acknowledges and helps every community in the state. We fully support the restoration of the aid program and thank you for your attention to this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. O'Rourke. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. In the interest of time, we have prepared a handout of the associations that have indicated support for this bill. And we'll just try to make a few comments. I think Commissioner Callison did a good job of explaining the history. But I do always appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of a Carlson bill. And also for a bill that Senator Rosen has carried twice and Representative Murphy carried last year as well. So the League of Cities does support this bill. It does benefit jurisdictions across the state, not only cities and counties, but any jurisdiction that has an employee in the PERA system. The program was established with a sunset date that was consistent with what the full funding date was for the plan at that time in 1997. And frankly, I can take responsibility for not catching this piece in Minnesota Statute 273.1385. That is a property tax statute, and I didn't think about the sunset date of this until last year. So I appreciate the patience of the commission in allowing us to identify this sunset and its implications for our jurisdictions around the state. So the League of Cities, the Association of Counties, Metro Cities, Municipal Legislative Commission, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and Minnesota Intercounty Association all support this legislation strongly. So with that, Madam Chair, I can turn it over to Mr. Hilger.
Mr. Hilger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, again, my name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'll be very quick and brief. We support this legislation and want to thank everyone for their bipartisan support of this provision. Just to kind of summarize, it's not just the big three, the city, county, and township associations that support this work, but think about all the special taxing jurisdictions that receive this aid. Libraries, historical societies, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, sanitary districts, municipal hospitals, redevelopment boards, county nursing homes, joint power commissions, and even municipal liquor stores. So when you think about the wide variety of taxing jurisdictions, local government associations, boards that receive it, it numbers over 3,000. And we thank you for your support. And while I wouldn't presume that everyone in this room tonight is here for PARA general aid, I would say that there is a large coalition of folks that are urging passage of this bill, and we look forward to working with members on both sides of the aisle, both chambers, to try to find a path this year to push it across the finish line. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman.
And thank you, Madam Chair and members. Matt Mossman, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, just here as an example of another of the many local government associations that want to add our voice to supporting this legislation and thanking the chair, author, Representative Carlson, Senator Rosen, and many others who have worked bipartisanly on this legislation last year. And really just want to call attention to that employer contribution expectations have continued to rise since 1997. So the rates are up about 45%. So this is one portion, and we just think represents a really important pledge that the legislature made in 1997 to participate in that progress towards full funding. And I think Senator Senjum said it really best earlier. There's been a lot of work done to try to ensure and restore and maintain PARA stability, and we really think that this goes a long way to just continuing to that same theme of making sure that PARA is on a good pathway without burdening property taxpayers towards full funding. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman? Mr. Fremke? Oh, Ms. Nauman. And then Mr. Rice. Ms. Nauman.
Just very briefly, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the executive director of Metro Cities, representing 92 municipalities in the metropolitan area. And we also do strongly support this bill and appreciate your consideration. So I'll be brief.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fremke.
Madam Chair, members of this most excellent committee, I'm here today representing public employees that are Teamster members. Our biggest, we have state employees, but our biggest grouping are folks in the PERA. Members are in PERA and PERA general. And we actually have some of the, besides cops and corrections officers who are in a PERA, we have probation officers who are actually in the general plan. We're the largest union of local probation officers. So we support this. We negotiate contracts with all of these entities, and we definitely want to make sure that these pension payments are made by the employers and they don't have to resort to other ways to tax and pay for the contracts and the employee contributions. Employer contributions, excuse me. Thank you.
Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice. I'm here tonight on behalf of AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 is a union of over 43,000 public employees in the state of Minnesota. Approximately 20,000 of AFSCME Council 5's members are members of the Minnesota State Retirement System, but over 23,000 are in the PARA General Plan. So we and by way of background, PARA General has 154,000 employees. It's your biggest pension plan by numbers, so it's very critical. We're here to support Senator Rosen's bill and Representative Carlson's bill, and thank them both for their effort. There, if I could approach Ms. Dieselin, I do have a handout. The handout that's going around, Madam Chair, is essentially the same. You have it in your packet. The staff prepared it. This one is in your packet. It's state aid for 2018 fiscal year 19, aid to fund local governments for PARA contribution increases. This is probably the most interesting document you're going to read. I know Senator Dames is aware of this document very carefully. The one in your packet is organized by Senate district, by number. And it's organized by Senate district, starting with the first district, going through to the metro area. And what it has, if you look at your Senate district, you'll see the employer jurisdiction with the most money that would be benefited by this program. The aid program amounts to $13.8 million. When you do the tax interactions, Senator Rosen, it reduces the cost to $13.2 million per year, because by giving local governments money, they'll reduce their property taxes, and there's an income tax effect on that. The document I handed out, we'll call it the more senior citizen document since I'm getting there, is this one, and it's organized by county alphabetically. So the first county is Aiken County, as we all know from our lessons, and it will list the county first and then the jurisdictions underneath it alphabetically. So depending on how you want to look at it, you've got two ways of checking it out. It's a very, very important aid program. There's over 1,500 jurisdictions, as Mr. Hilgarth mentioned, in the state. It really touches every unit of government. I know last year this was a late issue, but I know that Senator Dames and I spent some time in his office, and he's acutely familiar that the city of St. Leo gets $163 from this appropriation. His own city of Redwood Falls has about 10,000. The reason I bring up Senator Dames is I think he had the largest number of individual cities by Senate district that received the aids, but Senator Dames always seems to come out on every formula around this building. Yeah. Don't discount the farmers ever. But it really is very important in this aid program when we talk about numbers. The state has a number of aid programs, and you really are a partnership. When the new accounting standards have been adopted, any change to the funding level of these plans is going to affect cities and counties and everyone else down the line. And I think that really, Senator Senja mentioned that 2018 pension bill was 3 years in the making. Senator Rosen and Representative O'Driscoll chief authored that bill, but you had carried it previously, Representative Murphy, and Senator Pappas had in a prior year as chief author. It was bipartisan. It passed unanimously. It took 3 years to do it, but it really sewed together a lot of the funding issues with TRA, St. Paul Teachers, MSRS, all these other plans. I really do believe that the, and AFSCME believes that the state needs to be a partner in these pensions. You have been in the past. You know, currently the cost of this total plan is, this employer and the employee are putting in 14%. The normal cost, the total cost is about 13. But what I want to tell the commission, I guess, is this. The AFSCME and public employees are putting in 6.5% into this plan. The normal cost for the plan runs at about 7.75%. But what that means is the current working employees are paying for 84% of their benefit. The rest of the contributions that the cities and counties and school districts are making are not just for the working employees, but they're having to make up for the past deficits. And I think there is a good plan in place, but as we've just seen this last week, you want to be ready if there is a problem. The employees did come to the table last time. They cut their COLAs. They stayed behind their contribution increases, but we are paying a lot for this pension. And the negotiations, Representative O'Driscoll, to get to that big pension bill required shared sacrifice. The employees are putting in their money. The retirees came to the table and took, you know, COLAs that are very modest. We really do appreciate the help you gave Senator Rosen with the increased appropriations in 2018. And we know, Representative O'Driscoll, it was a big lift on your side, too. But if we ever have to face that situation again, on the employee side, the cupboards are kind of empty, honestly. I know probably don't want to hear that, but I mean, it would be asking for more money from the public employees right now. If you had to do it, would be a really big ask. So, and having the state at the table as a partner with all the cities and counties, the school districts, the municipal utilities, and everyone else is really important. Representative Carlson, I thank you for picking this bill up. Chair Murphy, you had it last year. You were extremely passionate. I remember the last pension commission, and someone who is maybe not as vocal, but really felt it strongly, was my own state representative, Diane Loeffler. She second chaired your bill last year. She had your job last year as the property tax chair. I think the House understood what this meant. Not that the Senate didn't, but the House property, the House Tax Committee has their own property tax committee, and I think they saw that this was very meaningful for all the jurisdictions in the state. Particularly some of the larger centers like Rochester, I mean, in places with hospitals, nursing homes, care facilities, And as Commissioner Callison testified, suburban cities, suburban communities do not get a lot of, they pay a lot of taxes by and large, and they don't get a lot of love. And this was one of the few aid programs that really did help out everywhere. And this money touched every corner of the state. So our plea to you and to the authors is somehow, if you can find a way to get this done this session, it would really be, I think, good pension policy. And it's something that would put the state in really good stead for the future. And last point would be, it's been said, but PARA was 80% funded in 97 when you created this program. It's still 80% funded today. We got a long way to go.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, welcome to pensions. That's all I can say. We actually like it. We love it. And I just want to make a clarification or state that this bill is not necessarily controversial. It is complicated just because of the spending in it. And we did make a significant investment in 2018. Unfortunately, this issue didn't show up until too late. And so even though the House had the hearing last year in taxes, I certainly want to stress that the Senate was very interested in this provision, but it's a timing issue, and it was all about getting it out in front and making sure that we had the funds to pay for it. And believe me, Madam Chair, I tried my damnedest. And I think you know that. I think even Senator Senjum got pulled into these conversations at the very end to try to see the path that we could thread for this bill last year. And that's what I am committed to doing this year. And that's why I would appreciate that if we did not incorporate it into the omnibus pension bill, and that we could find another path for this bill that would accommodate all the moving pieces upstairs and across the street.
And so your path?
Well, Madam Chair, if we are done with the discussion, I will make a motion that Senate file 4066 and House file 4018 be recommended to pass as a standalone bill and sent to the appropriate state government committees in both bodies.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Rosen can answer this, or the staff can. We missed a year because this didn't pass last year, or did we miss a year because this didn't pass last year? And are we paying back that year, or is this going forward and with the skip that we did?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I'm not sure if I understand your question, but we are going forward.
So going forward,
going forward,
Madam Chair, going forward. So we, because it didn't pass last year, we missed a year of payments to this.
No.
Oh, did we not?
No.
Okay. Okay. That's what I wanted to get my head around.
Okay.
We missed 6 months.
Yes. June 1st.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Two things that you have to remember. LGA is awarded on a January 1st through December 31st basis for the municipalities and the counties. And our fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th. And so even though this has a June 30th, 2020 expiration in here, quite frankly, if we don't take and move things now, we could miss a year in that process. And that is the last thing I think that we want to do as a legislature. One of the things that we found out after the 2018 bill was passed and signed by Governor Dayton was that the rating agencies were looking very closely at Minnesota as to what they wanted to do with them and how they wanted to keep a AAA credit rating with S&P. I do not want to do things that will jeopardize or send the wrong message to the broader markets, particularly in the turmoil that we see right now, that we would have people looking at Minnesota saying, maybe they don't have their house in order. We do, and this is a way to prove it. It's small potatoes. I suspect that with the downfall in interest rates that we've seen in the marketplace, if we do a bonding bill, Madam Chair, the interest savings on the bonding bill in a matter of a couple of years will pay for this thing itself. The money is just going to be there given the economics that we have. And if it means that we can run this bill, Senator Senjum, didn't mean to leave you out either, sir. All right. God, we got a lot of power players around the table in here in the legislature, don't we? But my point being that if we can move this independently and get it going, it sends the message faster in turbulent times to the broader market forces that are looking at us, because Myron Franz, Commissioner Franz, is going to have to be making a trip to New York again shortly after the 1st of July and have to explain what's going on in Minnesota, and this just helps him to be able to make a better case for Minnesota being on board. So if it makes sense, which it does to me, to try to get this done as fast as we can, and Representative Murphy, you know, because I offered a number of amendments on the floor last year on this so that it kept in front of the people in our chamber. And if we think we can run a faster path through state government finance and the finance chair from the Senate sitting here, I say we go for it. It does make the pension bill cleaner because there isn't any other appropriations in the pension bill, so it becomes policy. So there's a reason for doing that, and I'll be quiet for right now.
Sarah Rosen, you said to government operations, and then to the state government first?
Madam Chair.
Is that where?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is where it's been referred to. So I believe the path would be to Representative Nelson's committee and then on to Ways and Means and to state and to finance in the Senate.
Madam Chair, in the House, it would be government operations, then state gov finance, and then Ways and Means, yeah. But that's, yeah, okay. You've got the right path.
And no matter what, we have to check, because the local governments had to include the financing mm-hmm. in their predictions in December. But whatever you, I want to make sure, just like Representative Nelson said, that we don't miss 6 months. Mm-hmm. Okay, any further discussion? Anyone from the audience that wants to further testify?
Closing comment?
Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You always have to dumb it down a little bit for me, if you will. So I just thinking through this. So back in 1997, there was decisions made about moving forward with respect to a new PARA deal. And part of that deal suggested that if we did it at that point, that things are all going to all be well and good in 2020. And things aren't probably going to be all well and good in 2020, perhaps because of the recession. I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows that for me. But nonetheless, we're not there yet. And what this bill is about is simply continuing on, as I read the bill, until we've met that goal, or as it says, 2048. That's the essence of what we're doing here. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Can we bond for it?
Ms. Lancheski.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Stephanie James, Senate counsel, who helps us out with some of these procedural issues, just reminded me that this commission does not actually have possession mm-hmm. of the bill. It still is actually has been referred to the respective Senate and House GovOps committee. So I think what we can do here is to provide a recommendation back, but it's not an official referral or anything like that.
Right. Because when the elementary things get here, it's in the
critical box. Senator Rosen.
Oh, Chair, I didn't hear the question. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry.
It wasn't a question. It was kind of a statement saying that we don't have possession of this bill.
It's in GovOp.
So we should make a recommendation to the
Madam Chair, would you like me to withdraw my motion?
I don't know.
Modify.
Modify my motion?
Modify, okay. I think. That we make a recommendation to the committees to get that bill out.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to make a modify my motion to House File 4018 and Senate File 4066, that it is as a standalone bill and forward a recommendation to the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over state government operations. Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to say.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Rosen Amendment. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right.
Madam
All
Chair.
In favor?
This one home.
Yeah, everyone was in favor.
Yeah.
And so the recommendation will be sent to the committees for action. And then if they don't act, we will, at a later time, use the language that's in this in 2020, or in our 2020 pension bill. There's no action at that point. And maybe when our respective houses are talking targets, we will include the $14 million approximately for this bill in our targets to our leaders. Maybe I'll do it to my leader.
And Madam Chair.
Senator, you can include.
Madam Chair, I already did that today, actually, this afternoon. So it's good. On my radar, trust me.
Very good. All right, the next item on the agenda is number three. Where is she? Number four.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just thinking, you know, bonding bills are always the last to go, so you might have to carry this in your bonding bill.
My back is
I just needed some levity before we pass the next one.
Okay. Senator Thoms.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tonight we have Senate File 4202, and what this Senate file does is it make some amendments to the statutes governing the Public Employees Relation Association, PRA's, pension plans. These amendments do not significantly affect the amount of benefits or eligibility for a benefit, but make changes of administrative and technical late nature. And with that said, Madam Chair, I will move that Senate File 4202 be recommended to pass and be incorporated in the 2020 pension bill. And I would like to turn it over to Mr. Anderson and Ms. Strange. Mr. Anderson.
I'll turn it right over. Thank you, Senator. I'll turn it right over to Amy.
We're doing number two.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, thank you. So this is our PARA 2020 administrative bill, and I'll just take you through a walkthrough of the bill by section. The first section is section one, dealing with our seasonal employee definition. And we've had some confusion between our seasonal employee definition and our temporary employee definition. So all this simply does is match up the two. We'll be using the same time frame for seasonal employees, which is 6 months or less, rather than 185 consecutive calendar days. The second section makes alterations to a provision that was passed last year regarding our military service purchase. The language clarifies that a member may purchase up to a cumulative of 5 years, and will also allow a member to purchase in six-month increments beyond a year. And lastly, the employee must be employed for a period of 6 months before they can make this purchase. The Section 3 clarifies that in order to be able to receive a retirement annuity, a member must have a termination of public service instead of termination of membership. A termination of membership does not really occur when a member has terminated public service. So this is a clarification. Section 4 is one of three changes that conforms with changes made in the 2018 Omnibus Retirement Bill to adjust the time frame for retroactive payments. This language, it says a five-month look back, but administratively this turns into 6 months. So this language just clarifies that for the purposes of retirement annuity, our look-back period is 6 months. Section 5 makes that same change, but in regards to a bounce-back annuity. And then Section 6 makes that same change in regards to a retirement, in regards to a survivor benefit change. Section 7 corrects a cross-reference to 356.65. Section 8 clarifies changes that were made in the 2018 Omnibus Bill regarding augmentation. Section 9, 10, and 11 make changes to our phased retirement option, which was made a permanent part of our benefit structure last year. The first change is just to clarify that it is with the same position and the same employer. The second change in Section 10 addresses that termination requirements do not apply for a phased retirement member to receive an annuity. And the last change in Section 11 clarifies that upon a violation of the PRO agreement, the retirement annuity will be suspended the month the violation occurs. A violation of the PRO agreement occurs when the employee has exceeded the number of hours, whether in a pay period or in a calendar year. Section 12 makes a conforming change to our practice at PARA regarding vesting requirements for police and survivor benefits. It simply clarifies that the member has to be partially or totally vested in order to receive a survivor benefit. Section 13 makes it clear that we've had a situation where there's been some confusion if individuals over 55 with more than 20 years of service may apply for a disability benefit. This just makes it clear that they may not apply for a disability benefit. Section 14 again references that change to survivor benefits for police and fire members, that a member may only need to be partially or totally vested. That was Section 15. Section 14 makes that clarification change to say that members over 55 with more than 15 years of service cannot apply for a regular disability. Section 16 addresses a situation which came to light this past year in reviewing our administration of the police and fire duty disability payments paid to members from June 1, 2007 to December 31st, 2019. PARA paid disability benefits beyond normal retirement age, in which these benefits should have been considered taxable, and we issued them as non-taxable. The IRS permits plans to amend the plan document, in our case the statute, retroactively to address these members who received a duty disability beyond normal retirement age. Beginning January 1st, 2020, PARA has confirmed our practices to be in compliance with current law. Section 17, the last provision of the bill, eliminates a provision that allows a member to reduce their monthly benefit and subsequently restore it to the full amount.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, got a couple questions. One, we'll go backwards because on 16, when you talk about the retroactive, does that give a tax liability to people that received a benefit that they received as a non-taxable benefit? Does that give them a tax liability going back in their taxes?
No, it does not. This grants that benefit as we don't have to go back and adjust it. This is particularly for members that are 51, 52, and we gave them a 60-month, a five-year non-taxable benefit, so that brought them over the normal retirement age. We will not be changing anyone's. With this legislation, we do not have to go back and adjust their 1099-Rs.
And Madam Chair, the other question I had, and maybe I'm, the way I remember it, on the purchase of the military service credit, if I remember right, they were charged a fee, maybe I'm confusing that fee, to have to look up what it would cost. They were charged a $250 fee, if I remember right. Is that part of this also?
Yeah, that stays. So that $250 is any time that they would inquire and have us do the calculation for that purchase. If they make that purchase, that $250 goes towards their entire purchase.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I like this provision because all summer I was getting calls from members who would say, oh, check with Representative O'Driscoll. He was really involved in that. And so I'm glad to see that we've got the change in here, so maybe I can cut down on the number of phone calls that I get from constituents in other members' districts. But more importantly, I think, and I will let PERA speak to this, but they were getting requests, could I do it on a monthly basis? I think they had to draw a line and quantify it so that you weren't doing it on a monthly or a per pay period kind of a situation, because the costs of calculating plus the $250 fee every time just becomes rather onerous to the plan as well as to the participant. But again, I will let PERA speak to that. That's my findings.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And I remember last year we talked about when this was talked about, the $250 fee was that that people, so that when they're calling up to ask about it, they're not just calling and trying to figure it out and calling multiple times, that it did take a lot of staff time to do that. And this was way that, okay, if you do this, you're going to ask, we're going to charge you, but then we're going to, like they said, we're going to pay it, use that as part of what the cost of doing it, so.
And we only charge the administrative fee once we've actually done the calculation. It's not, we send information letters first and et cetera.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Dan, James?
Are there any other testifiers in the audience, Madam Chair?
Don't have anyone listed.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Heller?
Rick Heller, unofficial representative, twice exceptional people with print disabilities. Just to follow up on the agenda pieces, I don't see any handouts with the 40, the O2 bill in the back. I don't know if there's something that's supposed to be there, but also five of the handouts aren't currently online. I have this document I'm going to provide you for another handout, and we'll give one to Mr. Limmer as well for today. I'll leave it here for your pages. Greg with the LCC specifically told me, he's the director there, that they do not provide a page, are not required to provide a page. And then I went over to talk to Sergeant Arms, and you're not required to have a page. I don't want to interrupt these meetings and make this smooth, but it would be affordable for this group to have a page, so this doesn't have to happen again. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
And I do want to express, when you still have a Senate file, XXXX, this is a continuation for the last decade, and this one express again, the XXXX files are not fully accessible, so they get on the line for the public for struck through an underlined language. So your bill doesn't express that in one of the bills, but it would be appropriate for people don't get confused why we have XXXX files, because we don't currently have a definition of what that is. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that Senate File 4202 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 pension bill.
Senator, is there any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See no objection, it will be. And that leaves us with number four. Representative Nelson, Senator Rosen, who's got it?
Madam Chair, I'll make the motion that House File 4298 and Senate File 4203 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 pension bill. And the people from Perry here are to discuss and walk us through the bill.
What a surprise. Mr. Anderson, Stringy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director for PARA. So we'll talk about the disability. So this is a disability provisions are really probably the number one topic amongst our stakeholders, police and fire disability provisions. I hear more about it than funding concerns or any other issue. And what we hear from our stakeholders is twofold. One is from the members, the Police and Fire Plan members, who are very concerned with fairness of benefits. And then we hear from the employers, who are primarily concerned with the rising and unpredictable health care insurance costs. That's an issue that we're not going to talk about tonight as part of this bill. But we will visit the members' issue about fairness of benefits. We've been looking closely at our disability rates, kind of analyzing the data. What we see is that they can appear to be relatively low at times because they're generally less than 1% per year, but there is a pretty strong cumulative effect. And what we historically have had, and it's been increasing, is that by the time members reach retirement age, normal retirement age of 55, one out of every six retirees is a disability retiree. And again, that's trending up a little bit. So this is a trend that we see, and we're working to share all that data. We're not particularly concerned about pension plan costs, because what the plan provides for a disability retirement benefit isn't necessarily much different than a service retirement benefit, particularly if a disability occurs later in a career. Not saying we're not concerned, but we're not overly concerned about an increase in that trend. Again, what we really are concerned with is what our stakeholders talk about, and that's fairness of benefits. And that's what we want to address tonight. And we want to talk a little bit about the distinction between what is considered a disability benefit and what's considered a retirement benefit. And there's a real important distinction. It has to do with the taxability of these benefits. So for a disability benefit, to the extent it's considered a form of workers' compensation, it can be tax-free until normal retirement age, whereas retirement benefits are fully taxable. I'm going to draw your attention to two exhibits that we put together. And first, there's a chart. It's called the PARA Police and Fire Plan Duty Disability Taxability Example. So it's a spreadsheet looking. And the purpose of wanting to show this is to demonstrate just two examples. One is where it becomes fairly clear why there's a tax-free component to providing disability benefit, to the disability benefit. And the other example is where it's not necessarily apparent that there should be a tax-free component. I do want to caution the caveat that I have at the bottom of the page is these examples are meant to be sufficient to demonstrate those two main points. They do not reflect all the nuances of federal and state tax or unique member situations. Just want to make sure that's clear, that's on there. So the first example on the left-hand side in yellow just demonstrates what would happen if our average member became disabled. Average member is age 40 with about 12 years of service. Someone who's in that category is making about $90,000 per year. In column A, it just works through what the compensation is, reduced by the para contribution, looking at what part is taxable, what part would not be taxable, and what the employee's share of health care would cost. After making those adjustments, we would expect that member's take-home pay to be around $64,000 per year. If that member were disabled and there were no related tax relief for that benefit, that member would see a fairly significant drop in their take-home pay. That's column B. The level of take-home pay compared to if they were actively working would be 72% of the original amount. That's the highlighted in yellow middle of the page. Column C shows the importance of tax relief associated with the workers' comp disability benefit and how that helps to ensure or protect some of the income to that member. So again, this is just an example to show why it's important, where it applies, and it's there to help protect members in that situation. The second example is looking at someone who's at or near retirement. This is a member who's at age 55 with 30 years of service, a full career. Someone in that category would be making around $110,000 per year. That's the average in the plan. And in that case, if they were to retire, this is column E, based on the benefit provided, a regular retirement benefit, they'd have a replacement income of 94% of their original pay. In column F, it shows if tax relief were applied to this member, how beneficial that is, and it would create income higher than what the member would make prior to their retirement or if they continue to work. So, and these are provided as two distinct examples of one where it makes sense, where it's a disability-related benefit and the tax relief makes sense. One is the other case where it would be likely more viewed as a retirement benefit and the tax relief doesn't make sense. Moving on to the second exhibit. And a lot of the attempt here is to provide a little context about narrowing it down to the precise group that we're talking about tonight, because we're not talking about the vast majority of members. What's shown on this page, this scatter plot, is a one-year look at PARA's experience in the police and fire plan. Each dot represents a member that received a disability approval in fiscal year 19. So it's sort of by age and their years of service. So the members in zone one are under age 55, under 20 years of service. If they were disabled, their benefit would be 60% of pay, which is the minimum benefit. It's comparable to a 20-year career, and they would receive that tax-free until age 55. We have no proposed changes to that group. Zone two are members who are under 55 and over 20 years of service. Their benefit would be based on their actual service. So the 60% of pay benefit wouldn't apply. It would actually be 3% for each year of service. So they would receive the full benefit based on their total service. And that benefit would be, the first 60% of that benefit would be considered workers' comp related and tax-free until age 55. And there too, we propose no change to members who would be disabled in that grouping. Zone three, you would see that there are no dots in that group because we do not consider anyone who's over 55 and 20 is not eligible to receive a disability benefit. They're considered a retiree, not a disability. And there were 288 members in that category before, and we're not proposing any change there. What we're talking about is members in zone four who are over age 55 and have less than 20 years of service. And this is the question is, how are they treated? Is this a retirement benefit or is this a disability benefit? Ultimately, it's a question of, are they treated more like the members in zone three, in which they would receive a retirement benefit based on their service and it would be taxable? Or are they treated more like members in zone one, in which there would be a minimum benefit and it'd be tax-free for a period of time? So again, putting context on that, there were 240 active members out of almost 12,000. There's 11,800 active members in this plan overall. There's 242 are over age 55, under 20 years of service, and are active members. A lot of times these would be considered members as part of a second career in this plan. And there are six dots in that group. Three of them are clustered very closely, right over age 55 and just under age 20. Under 20 years of service, sorry, over age 55 and under 20 years of service. And then a fourth one also just under 20 years of service. PARA staff works on a lot of disability approvals over the course of a year, 100 this past year. And they are fairly aware of some of the nuanced language. And what they're finding and what they have pointed out is that there is at times opportunities that members may have to influence the timing of their disability approval. Whether that's in this particular case, it's a potential that if that approval occurs before 20 years of service, that would make them eligible for a benefit that would not be available to them if it occurred after 20 years of service. So this is an equitability issue that stakeholders see. They see a difference between what a member, two members the same age, one who's under a service threshold can receive a benefit of sorts, and one over a service threshold would not receive that benefit. So this is an area in which we see an opportunity to address one of the stakeholder issues about equitability and fairness of benefits. And that'll turn it to Amy.
I want to walk you through a little bit of what the board considered when they made this policy recommendation. The board and staff weighed some very important issues. First, I want to just take a step back and remind everyone what a duty disability is, what is comprised of. A duty disability benefit is comprised of a minimum benefit, which is equal to 20 years of service. That benefit is then non-taxable for a period of time, and the member is also eligible to receive continued health care paid by their employer through 299A. The member, in order to receive a duty disability, has to be essentially disabled in the hazards of the job. This does not preclude them from having any other job outside of this. It just says that you can't perform the duties of a police officer. A regular disability benefit is maxed out at a 15-year service benefit. And so the board took that into consideration and also looked at what the other plans were doing, both within PARA and outside of PARA. The board weighed first the policy of whether or not a disability benefit should be at age 55 or 60 months, whichever is greater, which is what our correctional plan is. But during that conversation, the board noted that there were unique differences between our PNF plan and the correctional plan. For example, a duty disability in the correctional plan receives 47.5% as a minimum benefit rather than 60, and there's no continued health care as well as a lower multiplier. There's also no total and permanent disability in the correctional plan. So the board decided that consistency for consistency's sake was not the appropriate policy here. The next issue that the board and staff considered very thoroughly was the ADEA, the Age Discrimination Act, and it is not discrimination under the ADEA to base eligibility benefits on age. When we are looking at issues beyond eligibility, it is not discrimination to consider pension status, which means things like service credit and vesting. In this case, the proposed change for members who are over 55 with less than 20 years of service relates to pension status because the change only impacts members with less than 20 years of service. When pension status is proxy for age, as in this case, the ADEA does not require the fund to make it a neutral decision. So that was considered by our general counsel, and we are confident with that opinion. The next issue that was raised was, Doug talked about it with his, with Exhibit A, is the purpose of a disability benefit. Disability benefits are intended to cover periods of a member is eligible for a retirement annuity. When a member is eligible for a retirement annuity, the need is largely eliminated. And so the board then considered it, and staff considered the impact to our membership. As Doug said, that there are 240 potentially impacted members. We typically see one to two a year. I would note that this change does not impact their access to continued health care. Members still have the ability to seek a duty determination to receive that continued health care. I will note that this is a benefit change for them. Our current law says that these members are eligible for a minimum benefit of 20 years. Our proposal does not allow them to receive a disability benefit, but rather fully vest them in a retirement annuity, which means that if they are 55 and have 5 years of service, instead of receiving 50% because of our graded vesting, they would receive the entirety of the five-year benefit. If they were 17 years, they would receive the entirety of the 17 years. So we considered that as well. Then the board decided that the disability benefit should continue to cease at normal retirement age, which is our current statute, and that individuals who are over 55 should not be eligible to receive a disability benefit. This, again, impacts those that are 55 and older with less than 20. And again, we are fully vesting them in a retirement annuity. I can walk through now the sections of the bill, given the context of what the board decided. The first section addresses duty disability, and we also took this opportunity to kind of clean up the statute to make it a little bit more readable. So ultimately, it breaks down the eligibility into three categories. The first is for members who are under 55. and have a condition that meets the definition of a duty disability and has filed a valid application, this member is entitled to receive that minimum benefit until the age of 55, at which point that benefit converts to retirement annuity and is fully taxable. The second category is a member who is over 55 but does not have 20 years of service. This and has a condition that meets the definition of duty disability and has filed a valid application. They do not receive a duty disability benefit. However, that individual is totally vested and entitled to their retirement annuity. The last category is a member who is over 55 with more than 20 years of service is not eligible to receive a duty disability. The second section just alters language for duty, total, and permanent to match that language that we changed. We are making no changes to duty, total, and permanent disability. If a member who's over 55 with less than 5 years of service would be impacted by that, they would receive that minimum benefit and everything that's entitled under a duty and total and permanent disability. The Section 3 removes a reference to the 60-month period for which duty disabilities are payable, and other changes are technical. Section 4 addresses regular disability. So again, we're making, we're having it divided into three categories. The first is for members who are under 55, has a condition that meets the definition of regular disability, and has filed a application. This member must be vested for 1 year or have 1 year of service to be eligible for this benefit. And they are eligible for 15 years max, and then at that point it converts to retirement annuity. A member who is over age 55 but does not have 15 years of service will be treated similarly, as they will be totally vested and entitled to a retirement annuity. A member who is over 55 with more than 15 years of service is not eligible to receive a regular disability, and it wouldn't be beneficial for them anyways, because a regular disability, again, is capped at 15 years. So they would not be receiving any credit for any additional years of service under a regular disability. Section 5 makes conforming changes to regular, total, and permanent disability. Section 6 eliminates the reference to a 60-month period, which was granted for a duty disability. And then Section 7 maintains that individuals who are under that Subdivision 1, Paragraph B, or Subdivision 3, Paragraph B, that the disability benefit is only for purposes of determining eligibility. So it's only for purposes of us waiving, essentially, the vesting requirements. And then lastly is the effective date, which is July 1st, 2020.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I got a couple questions here. And I met in my office earlier today with Mr. Anderson and Ms. String. But afterwards, I had some questions that were posed to me. And one was that, are we cutting people's benefits here? Is somebody going to get less of a benefit under this bill than they would have in the past?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, so I would point to the exhibit and give an example of how this would apply. So I reference the six dots there, four of which are very close to the 20 years of service level. So this would be a case where their benefit, currently under current law, they receive a benefit that's based on the 20-year minimum or 60%. Instead, their benefit would be slightly less in these examples. And under the change, it would be taxable as opposed to not taxable. The other example, there's a dot for a member who's 60 years old with 15 years of service. So the change, how it would apply to that member would be, instead of their benefit being the 20-year minimum or 60% of their pay, it'd be based on their 15 years or so of service, that amount instead. And that also would be not taxable because they're beyond age 55. And I will just point to the last example, just not to exclude it. The member who's about age 56 who has less than 10 years of service, their benefit would be less. It'd be based on their actual service. As Amy noted, they would be fully vested. But that's a case where we would assume that that person would have been the second career. There would be something from their employment from the time they started this plan, which is prior to age 45. That would be part of their benefit. Also, again, this is a duty disability, doesn't preclude a member from continuing to work in some capacity in some other job unrelated to police and fire.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question I have has to do with an issue that I, before session and the beginning of session, I got some emails from a gentleman that, actually there was a couple gentlemen, I think they were gentlemen, but a couple individuals that they asked about a duty disability. They got bad information, I guess would be the best way of saying it, that they thought they were going to qualify for a duty disability, but they were over 55, so they should not have been told, yes, you'll get a duty disability. They should have gone into the pension, and when they found that out, it appeared they were getting less money because they were going from a non-taxable state to a taxable state. And I guess, is that a miscommunication to these members, or was it a mistake somebody made?
I can address that issue. So first, the money, like the actual benefit that those members are receiving is exactly the same. What's different is that non-taxability piece. So a situation occurred last January where a question was raised whether or not individuals who were over 55 with more than 20 years of service and were actively employed could be eligible to apply for a duty disability benefit. We looked at that statute and determined that that was a viable claim. And at that point, individuals were allowed to apply for a duty disability benefit. When we went to see what that benefit should be, we realized that while they were able to apply, they weren't eligible to receive it due to our statute saying that duty disability benefit ends at normal retirement age and converts to a retirement annuity. Again, their actual benefit that they're receiving is the same. It's just that it's taxable versus it being non-taxable.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to kind of use Senator Senjum's proverbial dumb it down for me, but this is going to be bring it to reality check for me. So in my district, a Waseca police officer was shot in the line of duty at age 32, probably had about 7 years of service. How does this affect his disability as he goes forward? Again, because you mentioned something about 15 years, and I think my concern, obviously, we're in the lower left portion of Zone 1, and my concern is, you know, are we giving them enough disability when they're injured at this early of a stage in their career, given the age, and I think it's the 15-year benefit? Can you address that, how it affects this gentleman, just to bring it into reality check for me and maybe for the rest of the committee?
If that individual is awarded a duty disability benefit, he's awarded 20 years of service, which is 60% of his salary, and continued health care. If it's a duty total perm, and so that benefit is non-taxable until 55. If it is considered a duty total and permanent, he is awarded the 60%, and that benefit is non-taxable for life. This bill doesn't address any adequacy issues at that point in time. I know that there is a bill looking at the compensation of what our benefits are, and we are highly engaged in that and would love to have a conversation whether or not the benefits at that point for individuals like that are adequate.
Yep. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. The documents we have titled, and I'd say PRA, police and fire. The examples that Mr. Anderson and Mr. Engie were both giving tonight seem to be citing police officers. This is for both PRA, police and fire covered individuals. Am I correct?
Mr. Engie.
Correct.
Any further discussion?
We do have a testifier that would like to testify.
Yes, Mr. Peters.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Good evening.
My name is Brian Peters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I just have a quick statement, and I'll answer any questions if you have. I'm here to speak in support of House File 4298 and Senate File 4203 related to amendments impacting disability provisions of the Para Police and Fire Plan. The MPPOA works hard to understand the interests and concerns of our over 10,000 members, including issues related to disability and retirement benefits available to them from Para. Ensuring that benefits are reasonable and fair for all of our members is important to our organization. The MPPOA supports the decision by Para's board to seek changes to make a clear distinction between disability benefits and retirement annuity. We understand that the goal of the changes are not to maximize benefits or minimize costs, but to ensure reasonableness and equity. For example, we do not believe receiving disability benefits should be a means of achieving enhanced income after normal retirement age. The proposed changes are expected to impact a very small percentage of our members. However, we do believe it's important change to align with our organization's values. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Thank you, Mr. Peters. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 4298 and Senate File 4203 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 pension bill.
Any further discussion? All in favor of the Nelson motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Minutes, number one on the agenda.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'll move approval of the minutes from the March 3rd, 2020 meeting, my son's birthday.
There you go.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Mr. Heller?
Rick Heller again, Chair. Just so you know, I had asked, I know you just passed the bill, I mean this, the minutes, but on the end of non-agenda items, I just asked that you could okay the, put the word unofficial under after, insert unofficial after Rick Heller on page 3, because when I filled out the sign-in sheet, I that's what I write down, so thank you again.
Do that, Mr. Heller. Is there any other business to come before us tonight? If not, we will see you next Tuesday night, 5:00. This meeting is adjourned.